Chapter 2. Sally Page took a quick look at her Apple Watch as her feet pounded on the pavement. It was 8:30 on the dot. There were two women ahead of her pushing toddlers in strollers, so she looked over her shoulder to check that the road behind was clear, and then dropped into the gutter for 4 steps to overtake them. She was breathing slowly and evenly. It was just 4 miles from her flat in Fulham to her office in Wimbledon, and she always ran, rain or shine. It was partly for the exercise, but truth be told, she was pretty much addicted to running. She loved the feel of moving at speed under her own power, totally in control of her every movement. She ran over Putney Bridge, enjoying the cool breeze that blew along the Thames. There were two bridges connecting Fulham to Putney, a road bridge with pavements either side, and a rail bridge with a pedestrian and cycle bridge that ran alongside it. The problem with the rail bridge was that cyclists seemed to regard it as their own personal bridge, seeing runners as an alien species that needed to be put in their place. They always waited until the last second to change direction if they were heading towards her, often deliberately brushing her and throwing in a volley of verbal abuse for good measure. It was just easier to run on Putney Bridge, even though it was cluttered with pedestrians first thing in the morning. Sally always ran towards the traffic, and had done ever since 22nd of March 2017, when a Muslim fanatic by the name of Khalid Massoud had driven his car into pedestrians on the south side of Westminster Bridge, killing 4 people and injuring 50 more. He'd then gone on a knife rampage, murdering a policeman before being shot dead by an armed officer. From that day on, Sally had taken extra care when running across Putney Bridge. The pavement was almost a foot above the road, so she figured it was unlikely that a car would be able to mount the curb. But she knew that she would stand a better chance of surviving if the attack came from the front rather than the back. She ran off the bridge and headed up Putney High Street with its trendy mix of coffee shops, restaurants and hairdressers. She passed the Odeon Cinema on her left. The road became Putney Hill as it climbed south. Even in this sedate part of the city, running wasn't without its dangers, and she had to be constantly alert, especially when she was near shops. The pavements were usually fairly empty at that time of the morning, but what pedestrians there were regarded runners with contempt, if not outright hostility. As for motorists, they even hated each other, let alone those who travelled under their own steam. And even other runners seemed to regard her with disdain. Perhaps 1 in 5 would acknowledge her with a nod or a tight smile, but most either avoided eye contact or sneered judgmentally at her baggy tracksuit bottoms and University of Reading sweatshirt. Sally dressed for comfort while she ran, and her trainers were the only expensive item she was wearing. She had learned from experience that scrimping on running shoes was a big mistake. The ones on her feet that day were Reebok Float Ride Run Fast Pro shoes. They had cost more than £150, but were worth every penny. She had 2 pairs, pink and green, and she alternated them. Today she was wearing green. Each shoe weighed 3.5 ounces, less than her iPhone, but the underfoot platform offered plenty of support. She had her hair held back with a green scrunchie. She hadn't deliberately tried to colour coordinate with her trainers, it was just the luck of the draw, and her face was free of makeup. It was a cool March morning, and she had stopped wearing her beanie hat and fingerless gloves the previous month. By the time May came, she would probably switch her tracksuit bottoms for shorts, and swap the sweatshirt for a t-shirt, maybe even a vest. But everything she wore was functional, rather than decorative. Running wasn't about fashion. It was about running, period. Sally had been a runner for pretty much all of her 24 years. Even as a toddler, she had hurried everywhere, and she had started running for fun while still at primary school. At secondary school, the head of physical education had tried to encourage her to run for the county, but she had never been interested in running competitively. She ran for herself, and that was all there was to it. She reached a set of traffic lights, jogging on the spot, she waited for the little green man to appear. She took another quick look at her watch. 8:36. Bang on time. The green man flicked on, and she was just about to cross when a bike courier wearing black lycra flashed by. "Arso!" he shouted at the top of his voice. A bit unfair, considering he was clearly running a red light. She continued to run up Putney Hill. The road sloped up gradually, but it was still the toughest part of the run, and her calves began to burn. On the opposite side of the road, groups of neatly dressed schoolgirls in purple uniforms gathered in groups before heading into Putney High School, while others were being dropped off, mainly by glossy women driving SUVs. She reached the top of the hill and picked up speed. Putney Heath was to her right, bordered by the Green Man pub. There'd been a pub on the site since 1700, and back in the day, duelists would fortify themselves with a drink or two before heading off to the heath to fight to the death. Now that most duels were fought on social media, the pub was more commonly frequented by middle-class trendies and tourists, taking advantage of the pretty beer garden and better-than-average food. The area outside the pub was the terminus for the buses that served Putney, and there was always passengers waiting at the covered bus stop. She slowed as she crossed the road, and then sped up as she headed south. Some days she ran across Putney Heath, and then through Wimbledon Common, but she had hit the snooze button on her alarm clock, and spent an extra 10 minutes in bed that morning, so she stuck to the road. She much preferred running across the common, but the trails were uneven and littered with twigs and stones, so it slowed her pace. She felt the familiar burn in her calf muscles again, but she actually relished the discomfort, knowing that it was only by pushing her limits that she would improve. Her arms were powering up and down, and she felt the sweat beading on her neck and back, but her breathing stayed relaxed and even. She wasn't even close to being tired. 4 miles was nothing. On Saturdays and Sundays, she ran at least 12, and she had run the London Marathon route many times. She had never completed the marathon itself. She never wanted to run in a herd, but her solo times would always place her in the top 100 if she had taken part. She reached a set of traffic lights and jogged on the spot until she got the signal to cross. She ran over the A3, and now it was Wimbledon Common on her right. She raised her Apple Watch to her mouth as she ran. "What's my heart rate?" she asked. The heart rate app kicked in, and after a few seconds it gave her a reading of 125. She smiled. Not bad at all. She skirted the common, then followed the road to the right and ran past King's College School on her left and the stone-built, crooked Billet pub on the right. The pub was close enough to her place of work that she sometimes had lunch there, and it was where they went to celebrate promotions and birthdays. She looked both ways, waited for an SUV with 3 children in the back to roar by, then jogged across the road and headed down a side street. The house was 100 yards ahead of her, and she kept the pace up until she reached the front gate. Jogging on the spot, she opened it. It was a Victorian detached house with bay windows and a single garage to the right. The small front lawn had been paved over years earlier and was now used to store plastic rubbish bins. She went around to the rear of the house. The front door was only used for deliveries. Everyone else used the kitchen door. A CCTV camera looked down from the roof, one of 4 covering the approaches to the house. Another camera was fixed to the roof of the garage, aimed at the kitchen door. There was a metal keypad to the right of the door, and she tapped in the 6-digit code. The door mechanism clicked, and she pushed the door open and stepped inside. Tony Watson was staring into the fridge. She said hello, but he didn't turn to look at her. "The fridge isn't working again," he muttered. "The bloody thermostat. We'll be lucky if we don't all go down with food poisoning." Watson was in his late 20s, tall and gangly, with old acne scars peppering his cheeks. Sally figured he was probably gay, but he was a private person, par for the course in their line of work, so she knew next to nothing about him. He closed the fridge door, a can of Coke in his hand. "Bloody coffee maker's died too." Sally eased past him and opened the fridge. She kept her Evian water on the second shelf down, and she took out a bottle, unscrewed the top, and drank half before she went through to the hallway. There were two doors to the left. In a previous life, the room nearest the kitchen had been for dining, and the one at the front for sitting. They were both now used as offices, and were filled with filing cabinets, desks, and computers, though the worn carpets and flock wallpaper were original. The stairs were to the right, and Sally headed up them. The stair carpet was worn and frayed in places, and she had to be careful where she placed her feet. One of the men who worked on the upper floor, David Hansard, had taken a tumble a few months earlier and had twisted his knee badly. David was due to leave the house in a few weeks and was being cagey about where he was going. Sally worked in what had originally been the front bedroom of the house. There was a bay window overlooking the front garden and the street beyond. Drew Mountford was already at work, blinking through his thick-lensed glasses at two screens filled with images of children being abused. Mountford had taped plastic boards to the sides of his screens so that Sally couldn't see what he was watching from her desk, and she always averted her eyes when she walked behind him.
"Morning," he said. "Did they tell you the coffee maker's buggered?"
"Yeah," Tony said.
"Who do we talk to about getting a replacement?"
"Angie and Supplies. I'll call her."
"Cheers,"
said Mountford. "Hi, Fiona," said Sally, heading over to her desk. Sally was the longest serving in the house, so her desk was in the best position, facing the window. Fiona Hyde was the newest recruit in the house, a tall brunette who had recently graduated with a first-class degree in Arabic studies from the University of Manchester. Like Tony Watson, she was fluent in Arabic, and they always used the language to talk to each other, which Sally felt was both pretentious and annoying. Sally spoke reasonable French and passable German, but Tony and Fiona's language skills were at a whole different level.
"I don't know how you do it," sighed Fiona.
Her desk was facing the wall. She had moved soon after she'd been assigned to the house, so that she didn't have to look at Mountford's screens. Sally sat down and unzipped her backpack.
"Saves me a fortune on bus fares," she said.
She took out her fake Prada handbag and her genuine iPhone and put them next to her keyboard. Sally pulled open the bottom drawer of her desk, took out her wash bag and towel, and shoved her backpack in. Then she opened the pine wardrobe between her desk and Mountford's. Most of it was filled with files, but the original hanging rods were in place, and she used the left-hand side to store several work outfits. There were no written rules about how they were supposed to dress in the house, but most of the staffers dressed as if they were in head office, suits or blazers and trousers, though Fiona was a big fan of Ted Baker in Karen Millen dresses. Drew was an exception. He was close to retirement, and so he had taken to turning up in a sweatshirt and cargo pants. Sally had to make half a dozen tube journeys that day, so she chose a pair of black trousers, a dark blue shirt, and a black linen jacket. There were three pairs of shoes, and she took a pair of black pumps with low heels. She took her outfit, wash bag, and towel to the bathroom. It was small, a toilet against the far wall, a pink plastic bath with an electric shower to the right, and a wash basin to the left. The grouting between the white tiles had gone grey with age, and the ceiling was dotted with mould. There was a frosted window behind the sink, but it wouldn't open. The only ventilation came from a plastic fan set into the glass. That hadn't worked since Sally had moved into the house 2 years earlier. She closed the door, hung up her outfit, and placed her wash bag and towel on the lid of the toilet. She stripped off and stepped into the bath. The shower was a hit-and-miss affair. Sometimes the pressure was just right, and the water comfortably warm, but more often than not, there was a problem. Either a measly flow, or the temperature ice-cold or boiling hot. She took the showerhead and pointed it at the tiled wall as she pressed the button to start the water. She let it run for a few seconds, and then tested it. It was warm, so she fixed the head back into its holder and showered, using her own shampoo and body wash. When she'd finished, she toweled herself dry and put on her work outfit, Her hair was short enough that she never needed a dryer, and a few minutes brushing was all it took to make herself presentable. She hung her running gear in the wardrobe and put her trainers on the windowsill so that they would catch the sun. "Shall I do a coffee run if the machine's broken?" she asked. "I need my caffeine."
"I'd love a latte with an extra 2 shots, said Fiona, "and a chocolate muffin."
"You're an angel," said Mountford,
who was looking at a series of photographs of a middle-aged couple abusing what appeared to be a newborn baby. Paige shuddered and averted her eyes.
"I don't know how you can look at that stuff without puking," she said.
"Somebody's got to do it," said Mountford. "And it's not as if I've got a sex life to fuck with. Americano with a splash of milk," he said.
"I'll just check my diary and then I'll head out to Costa," said Sally. She dropped down onto her chair and logged onto her computer, keying in a password and pressing her right thumb on a small scanner. Once she had access to the system, she called up her diary and sat back as she ran through the list of the tasks she had to carry out. She was responsible for 2 dozen apartments and houses, and she was scheduled to visit 3 that day. 1 needed gas and electricity meter readings taken, which was a nuisance because the only way to get to the gas meter was to stand on a kitchen worktop. There were Amazon deliveries scheduled for the 2nd of the 3, and she had to give the 3rd one a quick clean. Her social media workload was much heavier. She had several dozen Twitter accounts, all of which had to be attended to, and as many Facebook and Instagram accounts too. Plus, she had 6 Oyster cards and a dozen shop loyalty cards, credit cards and debit cards that needed to be used. It was boring, run-of-the-mill stuff, but at least she didn't have to watch child porn. She leaned over and pressed her thumb against the reader on the front of the safe next to her desk. The locking mechanism clicked, and she turned the handle to open it. Inside were dozens of padded envelopes, each with a barcode and a name and address. She flicked through the envelopes and found the 3 that corresponded to that day's work. She closed the safe and put the envelopes on her desk. Each envelope contained a set of keys and a thumb drive with all the information about the property. She put the envelopes into her handbag. The Oyster cards, shop loyalty cards, and credit cards were in a filing cabinet, listed alphabetically under the name of the card owner. She took out all the cards she would be using that day, slotted them into a wallet, and put that into her bag too.
"Do you want a muffin or a croissant?" she asked Mountford.
"A banana chocolate muffin would go down a treat," said Mountford.
He fumbled in his pocket, but Sally told him he could pay her later.
"Actually, Sally, I'm going to work through lunch today," said Fiona. "Can you pick me up a salad or something?"
"Sure," said Sally. A memo flashed up on her screen. One of the houses she maintained was marked as out of bounds, meaning she wasn't to visit until the ban was lifted. It was a large house in Hampstead, the one she was due to clean. She was only expected to check that the house was spick and span and to make sure that all the lights and taps worked. But the cancellation meant a reduced workload, and she was grateful for small mercies. She picked up her handbag and phone.
"Right, I won't be long," she said.
Mountford waved but kept his eyes on his screens. The smaller bedroom was being used by Mo Chowdhury and David Hansard. They always worked with their door closed, and she knocked before opening. Both men were Sally's age, pretty much. Chowdhury was an IT specialist, who was forever moaning that his skills were being wasted. But Hansard's degree had been in drama, and he enjoyed playing different roles on Facebook and Twitter, so much so that sometimes his enthusiasm had to be reined in.
"I'm doing a coffee run, guys," she said.
Chowdhury twisted around in his seat. He had loosened his tie and tossed it over one shoulder. His hair was unkempt, as if he had just got out of bed. But Sally knew it was a look that took the best part of 5 minutes in front of the mirror to achieve.
"A nice cappuccino would be great, thanks," he said.
"Costa or Starbucks?"
asked Hansard, peering at one of his 2 screens.
"Costa,"
said Sally.
"I hate Starbucks,"
he said. "That's good, because I'm going to Costa."
"Get me a latte with an extra shot."
"What's the magic word?"
Now, he said. He turned around and grinned at her. Sorry, I'm giving this Manchester United fan some grief. He knows fuck all about football.
He pulled his wallet out, and before Sally could say that she'd catch him later, he had thrust a £10 note at her.
I'll buy Mo his coffee too.
You're a star, mate, said Chowdhury,
who was looking at one of his screens. It was a Twitter page, and Chowdhury had just tweeted a meme that featured a man in an orange jumpsuit having his head hacked off. Sally looked away and closed the door as she left. She went quickly down the stairs and knocked on the door to the front room before opening it. There were three workstations, but only one was occupied. Jane Burkett was about 10 years older than Sally. She'd joined the house after 5 years working for an NGO in Africa, and after just 3 months had been given a new assignment in head office, starting the following week. Sally, on the other hand, had been in the house for 2 years and was no nearer getting a new posting than the day she had moved in. She was pretty sure that it was her boss, Ian Hadley, who was blocking her move. Hadley had made a clumsy pass at her in the pub about a month after he'd joined, and while she'd rejected his advances with a smile and a laugh, he'd clearly taken offence and had been cold towards her ever since. All communication between them was by email, and he always referred to her as Ms. Page. Sally knew that it wasn't Jane's fault that she had leapfrogged over her, but she still found it hard to smile at the woman. Hi, Jane. I'm doing a Costa run. Can I get you anything? Jane looked over and grinned.
Brilliant, she said. I was thinking of going myself, but I've got a dozen Facebook pages to update by lunch.
No problem, said Sally. What do you want?
Decaf cappuccino, she said. Low-fat milk.
You've got it, said Sally,
though she really couldn't see the point of decaffeinated coffee. And be a love and pick me up a croissant, said Jane.
Will do, said Sally. Part of her wanted to point out that the calories in the croissant pretty much made a nonsense of the request for low-fat milk, but she just smiled. You can settle up with me when I get back.
It's going to rain, isn't it?
Asked Jane. Sally raised her Apple Watch to her mouth. What's the weather like? She said.
The weather's looking good today, up to 19 degrees, said Siri.
Sally had set the voice to a male South African, and every time it spoke, she pictured a tall, broad-shouldered, suntanned guy with blonde hair, wearing khaki shorts and carrying a large rifle. He was maybe driving a Land Rover, with a dead antelope strapped across the bonnet, which she always found strange, because she had been a vegetarian pretty much from birth.
You're such a tech geek, said Jane.
It's a great piece of kit, said Sally. It wakes me up, monitors my heart, checks on my activity levels, and reminds me what I'm supposed to be doing.
Sounds like my dad, laughed Jane.
There was only one person in the back room, a FIFA Faruqi. A FIFA was usually the first in the house and the last out, a hard worker who always seemed to be smiling. She'd been in the house for almost 5 months, and Sally had never seen her frown. Never mind get upset or angry. She had been born in Delhi, but had moved to the UK when she was 2 years old and had graduated with a first from either Oxford or Cambridge. Sally could never remember which. Afifa was wearing a pale blue hijab and was staring at her screen through her glasses.
Coffee run, Afifa. The machine has died, apparently, said Sally. Do you want anything?
I'd love a Cafe Misto, said Afifa.
What's a Cafe Misto? Asked Sally.
A 50-50 mix of fresh brewed coffee and steamed milk.
Cafe Misto it is, said Sally, and closed the door.
Tony Watson was still in the kitchen.
I'm doing a coffee run, said Sally. I'd kill for a nice latte, said Watson.
He held up the can of Coke.
I hate Coke.
Why did you buy it then?
I didn't. I just found it.
It had better not be Drew's. He goes apeshit when people take his stuff, said Sally. Watson put his hand in his pocket and took out a handful of change. You can pay me when I get back, Sally said, heading for the door. She went out and walked around to the driveway, then let herself out of the gate. A woman in a red coat was standing next to a large white poodle, which was trying to defecate in the gutter, and Sally couldn't help but smile at the look of concentration on the dog's face. The woman was whispering encouragement to the poodle and holding a blue plastic bag. Sally was pretty sure she made a habit of dumping the filled bags in the gutter, but she had never actually caught her in the act. The woman probably wasn't breaking the law. She was clearing up after her dog, which is what the law required, but instead of taking it home, she dropped the bag in the gutter when no one was watching. The woman caught Sally's smile and glared at her, so she looked away. Londoners didn't react well to smiles generally. The sky was clear and almost cloudless, but there was a nip in the air, so she walked faster to get her blood flowing. She wanted to run or at least jog, but the shoes she was wearing were only really up to a fast walk. There were only two people queuing when she got to Costa Coffee, and in less than a minute, a young Polish girl with green streaks in her blonde hair was taking Sally's order. It was complex, so Sally spoke clearly and slowly, hoping that she wasn't coming across as patronising. "So I need 8 coffees in all, with 2 muffins and a croissant and a salad, but I want to pay for them in 4 groups of 2. Does that make sense?"
"Perfect sense," said the girl, whose name tag identified her as Zofia.
Sally held up 4 debit cards.
"And I can just tap, right?"
Zofia smiled brightly.
"Yes, you can."
Sally split the order into 4 and tapped each of the cards onto the reader. She had 2 Costa loyalty cards in her wallet, and she handed them over.
"Put the 2 largest amounts on these," she said. "It doesn't matter which is which."
Zofia added the points to the cards and handed them back along with the 4 receipts. Sally thanked her, but she was already aiming her smile at the next customer. Sally stood at the end of the counter and waited for the 2 baristas to prepare her order. They were both guys, tall and dark-haired, and they spoke to each other in what sounded like an Eastern European language. One had short curly hair and a black plastic tunnel earring around the size of a 10-pence coin in his left ear. Sally understood the attraction of tattoos and piercings and had often thought about getting one or the other herself. But making a huge hole in your ear was mutilation rather than decoration. He turned suddenly and caught her staring at him. She blushed, but didn't look away, because that would make her appear guilty. Instead, she smiled.
"Jenny?" he said.
Sally nodded.
Jenny was the name she had given Zofia. "You drink a lot of coffee," he said.
She laughed. "It's for the office." He placed 2 coffees in front of her. His colleague put down another 2, then they went back to their machines. The equipment clanked and hissed, and the 2 baristas resumed talking to each other as they worked. When they had made all 8 coffees, the guy with the ear stretcher went to the food cabinet to get the muffins, croissant, and salad, while his colleague placed everything in 4 bags to match the orders that Sally had given Zofia. She thanked them and headed back outside. She walked quickly, 2 bags in each hand, her heels clicking on the pavement. 2 men were manoeuvring a boxed washing machine out of a delivery van. Looking at her, one of them muttered something, and they both laughed and nodded. Sally guessed that they were talking about her, and she flashed them a smile as she walked by.